It's Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bare on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to WHBL Legal Defense with Kirk and John. I guess this week we're just going to call it Legal Defense with John because Kirk could not be with us today. But that's okay because I've got a ton to talk about, and I'll just give you a little preview here. We are going to talk a lot about the Electoral College because, as all of you know, I'm sure if you're even drawing a breath and maybe mildly paying attention to the news, that the Electoral College will meet on Monday, December 19th, to elect the President of the United States. That's correct. You thought you voted on November 8th, and you did, but what you voted for was to have electors attend the Electoral College and thereby choose the president. Of course, we've talked a lot on the show about the Electoral College and kind of what we think about it in terms of whether it's a good idea, whether we should abolish it or whatever, but it's still here and it's happening. So the question becomes, how does it really work? And what could happen on Monday? In other words, what are the duties of the members of the Electoral College? Do they have to indeed follow what their state said to do? In other words, to vote for this candidate or that candidate? And it's a mixed bag, quite frankly, as to what they have to do. And what I'd like to take a deep dive into that. But there's some other things that are on my mind today, too. Also, some new FBI numbers are out on crime statistics. And we'll have the discussion about whether crime is indeed going up or down. One of the things that fascinates me about that question is because this is one that's so easily manipulated by politicians for whatever purpose they want to make it. You know, we heard it during the campaign. We heard about Donald Trump saying, I'm going to make America safe again, just replacing the word great just to have an auxiliary slogan, I guess. And then we heard some contrary statistics on the other side saying, no, it's actually a long-term trend that it's going down. So we're going to dive into that. And finally, I want to talk about diversion programs. And for those that aren't versed in the criminal justice system, this is whereby people avoid convictions by performing certain acts in terms of treatment or whatever, and they end up without a conviction, or they're just diverted out of the criminal justice system altogether. But more importantly, how these systems are now being manipulated by certain prosecutors around the country. So just sort of back up here a little bit to get into our main topic today, which is the Electoral College. What do we have to do? The electors who choose not to vote for the candidate that won their state are called faithless electors. And I think that's a bit of a misnomer. I think that's not accurate to use that kind of pejorative term with these particular people because they have, as a matter of state law, the answer about whether or not they have an obligation to ratify their state's popular vote is kind of mixed. Half the states have enacted measures that instruct electors to vote for their party's designated candidate. The rest have not. So the rest of the states, including Wisconsin, have electors that can vote for whoever they want. And even in states that tell their electors how to vote, the penalties for disobeying are really kind of modest, and frankly, they go unenforced. So I think that where do we start? We start with the Constitution. The Electoral College is a constitutional mandate, and that's why it's been such a, point of contention, because it's something that a lot of people don't like for good reason, but to get rid of it will require a constitutional amendment. Well, that's not entirely true, and I'll explain that later. But the Constitution only says that the Electoral College, quote, shall meet in their respective states and vote by ballot, end quote. That's it. There's some evidence to suggest that the framers envisioned an independent judgment of electors. And that's really what I want to dive into today. The reason was to check, to act as a check against populist passions. So the chief among them is somebody who's had a bit of a renaissance lately, and that's Alexander Hamilton. He wrote in the Federalist 68, which is something that I strongly encourage everybody to go Google. Obviously, you can Google anything these days. Go Google Federalist 68, and he said that the presidency should be decided, quote, by men most capable of analyzing the qualities adopted to the station and acting under circumstances favorable to the deliberation, end quote. So now I just want to sort of like take a deep dive into that and talk about what the founders really wanted when they created that. So one of the things was that they wanted to, one of the purposes was, is that they wanted to more evenly divide power throughout the country in terms of small states versus large states. And at that time, there wasn't really big cities like we have today. I mean, there was New York, and there was Philadelphia and Boston, but they weren't the, it was still a very rural society. But still, you know, some states were more less populated, and some states were more populated. And so they to even that out a little bit, that's part of the purpose of the Electoral College. But it was also had to do with slavery. Because if you remember, in the Constitution, there's something called the Three-Fifths Clause. The Three-Fifths Clause says that for all persons that are, they don't use the word slavery, but that are otherwise not citizens, in other words, slaves, they would count three-fifths of that number towards your population for the purposes of allotting members of Congress, how many congressional members you have, and also for purposes of the Electoral College, obviously. So it was really kind of a political compromise, and so for that reason, slavery was kind of baked into the Constitution. So Hamilton then says, though, on a more, I guess, introspective level, is that you get to choose electors to the Electoral College, you get to choose. You're going to be chosen by the members of your state. But when you come to vote at the Electoral College meeting, you have to bring independent judgment. And so the process of well, let's just actually take some direct quotes directly from Hamilton's own words. He says, quote, "The process of election affords a moral certainty that the office of president will never fall to the lot of any man who is not in an eminent degree endowed with the requisite qualifications. Talents for low intrigue and the little arts of popularity may alone suffice to elevate a man to the first honors in a single state, but it will require other talents and a different kind of merit to establish him in the esteem and confidence of the whole Union, or of so considerate a portion of it as it would be necessary to make him a successful candidate for the distinguished office of the President of the United States. It will not be too strong to say that there will be a constant probability of seeing the station filled by characters preeminent for ability and virtue, and this will be thought no inconsiderable recommendation of the Constitution by those who are able to estimate the share which the executive in every government must necessarily have in its good or ill administration. Though we cannot acquiesce in the political heresy of the poet who says, for forms of government let fools contest that which is best administered is best, yet we may safely pronounce that the true test of a good government is its aptitude and tendency to produce a good administration," end quote. So what he's saying there is that you, electors, have to bring some judgment to this decision. And you're not just there as a puppet to, you know, kind of, I guess, just rubber stamp whatever it is your state says. And that's what it's sort of devolved into. For the first 10 years of the United States history, that's what happened. That's the way it was carried out. And then after that, it became kind of a rubber stamp. And so I guess the question we have to ask ourselves, are we living in remarkable times that's going to require this remarkable solution, I guess, for lack of a better term? Yeah, well, that's, I guess, the question to be debated. And I doubt it. I doubt it's going to happen, but I think it's an important conversation to have. Well, listen, we're coming up on a break here, and I want you to pay attention to, while we pay the bills, pay attention to what our sponsors have to say, and I will be right back. We have a lot more to talk about.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense with Kirk and John. Well, I'm just going to just say Legal Defense with John today. and I wanted just to continue this discussion about the Electoral College because it's so critically important in this particular context of our history. And that's history actually is something that's so commonly and easily manipulated and or conveniently forgotten in terms of how we're going to view things now or looking forward. So that's why I think it's so critical that we examine this question of the Electoral College in the context in which it was designed. So Hamilton says that we have to have a moral certainty about who we're electing. And in order to do that, he says that these electors have to bring to the table, and I'm paraphrasing here, obviously, they have to bring to the table some independent judgment. So is this what we're living in now? Is this a situation where electors, and some of them have already stated that they intend to vote their conscience and not vote for Donald Trump? Is that the times we're living in? Is this something that could actually happen? Well, in the box of anything could happen anytime, well, of course. But in reality, I think it would be probably a highly unlikely thing to happen. But pledged electors, who, again, are called faithless electors if they vote against what their state had mandated, have rarely used that discretion. And I think it's fairly settled. I don't think anybody could really make an argument to say that they're absolutely bound by what their states did. It's sort of been an afterthought in most elections before this, but it's not an afterthought now. It's a very serious consideration. As we saw for the weeks following the election with protests around the country. I mean, just spontaneous protesters. But it's never happened before. They've rarely used this discretion, and it's never in any way altered the outcome of a presidential race. So in a sense, it's a good thing that that's true, because voters then, you and I, when we go to the polls, we know that if the candidate that we voted for gets the majority of the votes in our state, that those electors are going to be bound by our wishes, our being the citizens' wishes. So it's kind of a two-edged sword in that sense that, you know, if you don't, it's kind of like overturning a jury's verdict. So the jury votes on a particular case, and the jury then makes a decision. They make a communal decision, and if it's a civil case, you know, they have to have, I think, 10 out of 12, and if it's a criminal case, it has to be unanimous. And so, and in a criminal case, you can move for a, or in a civil case, a party who is loses can ask the judge for what's called a judgment notwithstanding the verdict, JNOV. And the judge then, if he or she finds that the verdict is so outrageously not in line with what the evidence of the case was, can overturn the verdict. And indeed, that has happened. And the reason that we give judges that kind of power is to correct times when, frankly, things just go off the rails. You know, this sort of situation might occur, and for example, a racially charged situation where an all-white jury convicts a black man and for literally little or no evidence. Well, most of those times that's happened, and that's happened a lot in our history, and it wasn't overturned. But the judge can overturn it, or if it's a civil case and something is, you know, that it's real clear that the jury was just like being vindictive against a particular company or something like that, he can overturn that verdict, and enter into judgment on the case what he thinks is more appropriate. Now, you know, I think people correctly have some problems with that. Because we're giving an awful lot of power to one man or woman, and we're taking away what the citizens have deemed their communal judgment. And that's a problem. On the other hand, it's real easy to see how that communal decision can be awful and unfair and unconstitutional. And if the Constitution's about anything, it's about trying to be fair, and it's about trying to share power. It's about divided government and divided power structures so that no one person, no one branch can run roughshod over the rest of them. And quite frankly, that brings us, I guess, full circle back to Donald Trump and the current situation that we find ourselves in, where indeed, for really the first time in our history, I think, that we're in danger of allowing that sort of singular focus of power in one person, or at least in one branch. And, you know, you can still say, well, the Congress is still there, and there still can be a check and balance on the presidential power. But is that the case? Or has Trump so, I guess, swallowed the centers of power through his electoral strength that's not the case anymore, that the separation of powers is really kind of an illusion at this point? It's hard to say. It's really hard to say, because the man just surprised the hell out of everybody constantly as far as his, I guess, magnetic ability to overcome anything that was thrown in his way. That brings us, I guess, to the Electoral College vis-a-vis, do you have a duty, electors? Do you have a duty to stop what you think is, a potentially ruin for the country? I'm putting it in kind of more fatalistic, I guess, terms than it probably deserves. But that's the question that some people are asking. So I guess the question that all of us have to ask is, where do we stand on this? So where do you stand on that? Ask yourself that question. Quite frankly, I'm kind of feeling mixed about the whole thing. I did not support Donald Trump. I don't like him. I think he's kind of dangerous in a lot of ways. I think it's very possible he could get us into a war. I think it's very possible he could sink the economy into recession. On the other hand, two other thoughts come to mind. Number one is he won, and seemingly fair and square, despite the whole Russian hacking thing. And two is that maybe he's crazy like a fox. I'm gonna give him enough credit to say, even though he does and says seemingly stupid things all the time, he is not a stupid man. And the people around him, even though they you know, his recent cabinet picks, even though they kind of seem like they might be a bit on the fringe element side, they're not stupid either. So, you know, I mean, I understand the arguments on some people say this is looking a little Hitlerish, a little Nazi-ish, a little 1930s German-ish, but does that mean that we electors of the Electoral College overturn the judgment of the people? Well, wait, they say. Wait, people say. You know, he wasn't the choice of the people. He was the second choice. Hillary Clinton was the choice of the people by 2 or 3 million votes. I think 3 was what I last I heard. Actually, I think that might have been edged up a little bit more. I don't have the exact numbers. But so what do we do about that? Do we act as a judge and overturn the verdict of the jury? Or maybe the question has to be asked, was indeed this the verdict of the jury? Well, it kind of was if the jury is the Electoral College, at least numerically, if not as to each person. So it's kind of really difficult to say what if this is the type of person that Hamilton feared, an unqualified trickster with, quote, talents for low intrigue and the little arts of popularity, end quote. well, whether he is or not, a lot of people see him as a one-man constitutional crisis who empowers white nationalists. He conflates his business interests with the public good and apparently displays contempt for the rule of law. You know, as much as people say, oh, you know, I'm all for the rule of law, he seems to be kind of flouting it at times. Well, anyways, we're coming up on a break. Just something to think about. Go read the Federalist 68. You will be that deep dive into history will be an eye opener for you.
Now, back to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
The hat I got for Christmas is too big. It's nice, but my sombrero is too big. Is it raining? Is it snowing? I can't see where I am going, 'cause the hat I got for Christmas is too big.
Oh, welcome back to Legal Defense on WHBL 101.5 FM, 1330 AM. So, the Electoral College. Well, when we left, we were talking about, we were just, I guess, posing the question about whether or not this antiquated system needs to stick around. And, you know, I'd just like to conclude this part of the discussion in leaving, I guess, in your thoughts and from your perspective, just some things to consider. So there's a bit of a campaign now to, as we said, overturn the jury's verdict, overturn the election by the electors choosing somebody other than Donald Trump. And in which case, a number of things could occur. They could pick somebody else entirely, or this whole thing could get kicked to the House of Representatives, which, of course, is controlled by Republicans and would most certainly, line up with Donald Trump on this particular issue. But if the campaign to undo the election results, or at least the Electoral College version of it, if that reveals that the electors by and large feel compelled to behave like, quote, party lackeys and intellectual non-entities, as Justice Robert Jackson once put it, then the college serves no redeeming function. On the other hand, if the electors begin to feel increasingly emboldened to disregard their state vote, then we kind of have a recipe for partisan mischief and structural instability, which frankly should scare all Americans. You know, if this campaign is mounted in any sort of serious and large fashion and it fails, it may be this effort to thwart Trump's presidency could cause destructive political alienation, frankly, and social unrest. And is the game really worth it? A failed attempt might only feed Trump's paranoia and aggravate his sort of illiberal tendencies. So I guess we're going to leave it there. It doesn't seem to be any good way to attack this. The electors can do what they want, but just assuming even that we could find a critical mass number of them willing to do that, could the damage be even worse? I mean, the whole drain the swamp thing that was so effective and spoke to so many people in this country, people who don't necessarily want anything that Donald Trump proposes, but they just don't want anything that these establishment politicians and corporate-owned political parties that we have, they don't want any of that either. That's mostly what that was about. So would it do more harm than good? Probably. So the bigger question, the overarching question is, going forward, do we just do away with it? And I think after, and this is just my opinion, but I think after all is said and done, I think that's probably the way to go. And it disappoints me to say that because, frankly, Wisconsin always seems to play a critical role in at least most of the modern elections that have taken place over the last 20, 30 years. Because we have we don't have a lot of electoral votes with 13, but we do, we're often seen as a battleground state, which we certainly were this time around, along with Michigan and Pennsylvania. And I don't want to see us forgotten. And I want politicians to pay attention to the middle of the country. I like the fact that the first battleground in every single election is Iowa. Not that, you know, I mean, it's a tiny little state with tiny towns and, you know, and but it's always a critical one, or New Hampshire for that matter. And who's going to pay attention to those little hamlets? I don't know. It's a hard call. It truly is. But I think at the end of the day, the will of the people has to be respected. And so the popular will of the people. And yes, that's going to put us in danger of being forgotten in, here in the middle of the country, and that just large moneyed interests in New York and Miami and Los Angeles and Washington and San Francisco are going to rule the day. So it's going to be kind of a bi-coastal country with a bunch of us in the middle. And that indeed could be a danger, but in a sense, that's already what's occurred. And the Senate used to be chosen by, that was not popular, they were not popularly elected. That took a constitutional amendment to change that. And the reason that was done, is because we want the people to be electing their leaders, even if there's sort of bitter division. So we think there's bitter division now, and there is. And there's a lot of dysfunction. But let's think back on other times when there was bitter division. And really, where does that come to? Slavery. I mean, we fought a war over it. And really, in a sense, we're still living in the fallout of the Civil War. And the racial discrimination that ensued afterwards, and continues to this day, albeit in a very different form and much improved form in a lot of ways. I mean, there was a lot of successes along the way, but we're still, that what's underlying the division is at least partially racial, but it's also heavily economic. And I heard a very interesting discussion, actually, that really opened my eyes, and I'd like to share it with you a little bit about that economic component of the divisions that we're seeing and feeling in the country, and that is that post-World War II, everybody looks at that as sort of these glory years, these wonderful, amazing economic times that occurred in the 1950s. And indeed, that's exactly what they were. I mean, we were at peace. We were, well, after the Korean War ended, we were at peace. The economy was roaring. Detroit was, you know, basically owned the world in terms of making the automobile, the central part of America's life. And of course, that was enabled by the creation of the interstate highway system. But a number of economists have pointed out, I think correctly, that what we view as that's what we viewed as normal is very abnormal. And the reason that we were able to be so successful is because of World War II. And, and Europe and Japan were in ruins. Their economies were absolutely in tatters. And so all the production in the world had to be done by us. And indeed it was. And that's why we dominated so much and so for so long and became, there was two superpowers, but really, economically, there was just the United States. And so now that sort of we're globalizing a lot of that manufacturing infrastructure, and there's a lot of angst about that, and I understand that. I mean, it's really hard to watch these factories go overseas and, for low-wage labor. The unions are upset about it. And even businesses that move their businesses overseas probably really don't want to. But when they crunch the numbers, it's the only way they can stay in business. So with this globalized sort of thinning out, if you will, of our economic manufacturing base, among other things, that's really the more normal way that our economy should be, more normal state, I should say. And that, rapid economic growth like we saw in the 50s and then again in the 80s is actually really abnormal. And what we're seeing now is really more than normal. So post-Great Recession recovery has been criticized by so many on the right as, anemic and it's pathetic and blah, blah, blah. It's like slow growth and, but really, when you look at the overarching economic trends, it's really more the way it's supposed to be economically. And of course, we're kind of reeling a little bit from this. And obviously, the people that held those jobs really staged a revolt here. They feel forgotten. And I get that. In Sheboygan, there's still a lot of those great jobs. I think people in Sheboygan County should be very grateful for the amount of manufacturing and solid, good-paying jobs with solid companies that are available there. So listen, we're coming up on a break here. There are some other subjects I want to get to, but right now, please listen to these messages from our sponsors while we pay the bills.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
I'll have a blue at Christmas without you. Blue.
Welcome back to Legal Defense on WHBL 101.5, 1330 AM. 101.5 FM, sorry, should say that. Enough of the Electoral College. I want to shift gears here a little bit and talk about actually two different subjects. The first one is crime statistics. And this is something that everybody seems to have an opinion on, but nobody seems to agree on whether crime is going up or crime is going down. And so let's try and put that into a little bit of context. And because the reason it's so important is because politicians love to pass criminal laws. State politicians love it. Federal politicians love it. And the reason is because it's a no-brainer. Back Back when I was a young lawyer coming up in the 90s, let me tell you something. Tommy Thompson, who I liked in a lot of respects, he sensed, his political instincts were amazing, but he sensed like when to take on an issue, and he took on crime as an issue. He was living, we were living, in a roaring economy with tech boom starting to, you know, just like, I guess, over inflate just, you know, the true value of the economy. But anyways, we were able, he was able, to go on a prison building binge that lasted that whole decade and really probably started before then. But we quadrupled in Wisconsin our prison population from about 4,000 to, like, we're in the low 20s now. And even though there's a pendulum swinging back to try and correct that, because our neighbors, I believe all of our neighbors, Michigan, Minnesota, Iowa, we won't talk about Illinois, it's a little different story, but those other neighbors all have prison populations about the same as that we did. We just decided to go in another direction. And the reason is because it's really, really easy for politicians to pass draconian and harsh penalties and fill those prisons with, vast majority are black people from Milwaukee. And it's really easy because people that are accused of crimes have little to no power. Who really cares about them? Nobody does. Nobody does. So it's really great headlines, easy constituency to pick on, people with no money and no power, and everybody's happy except for the people that are going to prison. So, and how did he do that? Well, he did it on the back of the war on drugs. There's really little to talk about that. Little to contradict that. But, you know, that's a different story than the one we're wrestling with now. Because the real question is now is not whether crime is falling or rising. In terms of a long-term trend, I think the consensus is in that it's been falling over the years. But is it rising back up now? Are we in the middle of a rise, at least in violent crime? And the answer is kind of mixed. So the FBI collects and handles crime data from, 18,000 police agencies, across the country. And there was a Marshall Project, which is an organization that deals with criminal justice issues. There was a Marshall Project analysis of 40 years of FBI data of the most serious violent crimes in 68 police jurisdictions. And that analysis went from 1975 to 2015, and it found that violent crime in those jurisdictions only rose 2.2% last year. And nationally, violent crime rose 3%. Okay? So that was just from last year. But there's a wide variation from community to community. You know, there's an old saying about politics that all politics are local. Well, all crime is local. And indeed, if you even within cities, from neighborhood to neighborhood, there can be wide variations in crime rates. And a recent study even advanced the proposition that 5% of city blocks account for 50% of the crime. So that's what makes it really, really hard to tease out any sort of actual trends in terms of overall crime rate, because it's not really, there's not really a way to structure that statistical analysis. So in other words, if you're living in a really bad area, then, you're going to think the crime is like your number one thing. And if you're living in a white affluent suburb, or you're living in a very, upscale sort of Tony area of the city, you're going to think, well, crime's not a problem. Because we think that something's a problem if we see it. And if we don't see the crime, if we don't see that going on, then we don't, it's sort of out of sight, out of mind. And that sort of segregation, if you will, of crime neighborhoods is what leads us, I guess, to continue that or to want to not change in terms of that sort of segregation. At least that's the case in the city of Milwaukee, the most segregated city in the country. So, but the rate of violent crime was up in Milwaukee 236% between 1975 and 2015. That's a lot. That's a lot. But as a matter of perspective, there's other cities that were way worse than Milwaukee, way worse. And we have to ask ourselves, what are we going to do about that? Was that all connected to the war on drugs, the violent crime rate? Is that something that is going to prevent us, I guess, from coming up with some sort of solutions to poverty, inner city, education, things that actually could impact, if developed correctly, could impact that crime rate? Or reduce it, or fundamentally, change the perspective of people about that. So one of the things, and this is the second topic I wanted to talk about, was diversion programs. So this has been used with wild success in Milwaukee County. And I'll give our District Attorney John Chisholm a lot of credit. When he came into office, he basically said, okay, the war on drugs is not over, but we're going to take a whole different path. And if you are a nonviolent first offender, we're not going to put you in jail. We're not going to label you a felon or a criminal for the rest of your life. We're going to put you into treatment, and you're going to go through the system. But at the end of the day, we're going to divert you from we're going to dismiss the case. And in fact, there's drug treatment courts in Milwaukee, there's gun courts in Milwaukee, there's all these specialty courts. And the diversion courts are, I think, one of the most progressive and wise things that we've done in our criminal justice system, at least in the last few decades. And it's really a reaction to the war on drugs. And I think it's a reaction to that segregation and rise in violent crime that we've seen in both Milwaukee and in other major cities. So, but in the broader context, these numbers that we were just talking about really show that crime remains near record lows. And that's what, and in fact, since 2008, the national rate of violent crime has been lower than at any point since 1976. So really, when we're really just talking about an uptick in several major cities, in terms of violent crime, and I mean, I know Donald Trump in the election made a lot about how many murders there were in Chicago last year, and how many shootings there were, and of course the NRA points to that and says, and that's the city that has the most restrictive gun laws too. Okay, and of course we're just talking apples and oranges there, but those sorts of cherry picking of statistics is what we need to get away from. We need to have a different discussion. We need to have a different perspective, if you will, on what we're going to be talking about in terms of crime policy. And I was very encouraged the last few years to have some discussion about, criminal justice reform. Now, it's largely focused on sentencing, which is an appropriate thing to focus on. But I think part of that discussion has to get away from what the crime rate is or all of that. And we have to get down to some actual fundamental things like bail reform. Because the vast majority of people that are in jail because they can't afford to get out. It's not because they've been sentenced to prisons. They're in jail because their case is pending and they can't afford the bail that's been imposed. And a lot of times they were arrested because they couldn't afford to pay their fines. So, listen, we're going to have to leave it there for now. But thank you very much for joining me this morning. I hope you're surviving the snow. And it would be very interesting to see what happens with the Electoral College. But Enjoy this coming white Christmas, though, and let that be a joyous part of your holiday season. I know it will be for me. And thank you very much for joining us, and we'll see you next week again on WHBL 101.5 FM, 1330 AM. Have a great weekend.